As the tense standoff continues in the Crimean Peninsula, the focus of efforts to end the crisis peacefully shifts to Paris. This hour, what happens next? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and President Obama said Russia's explanation for its actions in Ukraine doesn't line up with reality. Today we discuss the crisis also in historical context with political science professor Bill Reisinger of the University of Iowa. He's researched and written about the politics of the post-communist countries extensively. Also, a regular political analyst, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, will be with us. What are your questions and concerns about the crisis? Join our discussion after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Day has once again arrived, and once again our focus this week on the crisis in Ukraine. It has unfurled at a breakneck pace. What started as small protests became a nationwide movement, and then a violent crackdown. Bloodshed gave way to a new government in Kiev. Then the Russian takeover of the Crimean Peninsula. It caught many by surprise. It was an incursion that has set off a volley of threats, counter-threats, a crisis that reminds us of the Cold War. And now Russian President Vladimir Putin faces mounting pressure from Western powers to loosen his grip on Crimea. A big question, what is Putin's endgame? Later in the program, our regular political analyst Jim McCormick of Iowa State University will join us. But first, William Reisinger is with us, professor of politics at the University of Iowa. He teaches courses on democratization, authoritarian politics, and the politics of post-communist countries. He's written numerous books, many articles on this topic. He travels frequently to Russia and has conducted research as well in Ukraine. Bill Reisinger, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
What are at the heart of Russia's concerns?
Well, Russia, of course, is going to be very concerned about the stance of this important neighbor just because of its location so close to a long stretch of Russia's borders. But even beyond that, Ukraine is the place from which Russia, as a culture and a people and a state, sprang back in the 9th century. Kievan Rus is the start of Russia, and so Russians will look to what is present-day Ukraine as part of their homeland. And it's a part of what had been the Soviet Union, and so the same country as Russia up until the early 1990s. And so there are strategic and cultural and, importantly, economic trade issues that make Ukraine of very high importance for Russian foreign policy.
Explain that a little bit more about why or how Russia sprang from Ukraine, from Kiev.
Well, the people that we now think of as Russia and the traditions, the political and other traditions that Russians see themselves as the heirs to began in the part of the world around Kiev and the Dnieper River. And then as population grew and as the state expanded, the population moved to the north and east, closer to present-day Moscow and areas beyond. And then there was an invasion from the east that put an end to the Kievan states, and after that, the central power of Russia as a state was located around today's Moscow. So there is that change in the center point of what is Russia, but they still look back to Kiev as really part of their heritage. So emotionally and in terms of Russians' identity and history, they feel that they have a great stake in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. So take us, speaking now of the present day, what are President Putin's greatest fears? This was all set off evidently with progress in economic ties between Ukraine and the European Union. Why would that set it off, and what did Putin fear happening?
Well, there's sort of both the two things, the security and the economic, that we need to think about. On the economic ground seem to be the match that lit this fire, and that was potential for Ukraine to focus its trade and its economic relations much more strongly to the West, perhaps eventually leading to Ukraine becoming a member of the European Union. The trouble with that would thwart plans that Putin has been developing to create a greater free trade space among former republics of the Soviet Union, the post-Soviet countries, both Ukraine, Belarus, Central Asia, and the Caucasus, to create a Eurasian customs union. And so that would have gotten in the way of some concrete plans Russia has for its economic future and its foreign trade in the region. But, of course, bringing Ukraine into the European Union would be a step toward bringing the West, and not just the European Union, but NATO and other things, closer to Russia's doorstep. So it had real security issues as well, and it posed the possibility of a Ukraine that would, in its foreign policy, not just be ambivalent toward Russia, but would actually be hostile to Russia. And so from Russia's point of view, it looks like something that we experienced during the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, enemy powers coming right to our doorstep in a hostile fashion, and it therefore is something that Putin was just determined not to allow to happen.
Mm-hmm. And so the way you're talking, it really is as if the Cold War has returned or never went away. We're just being made aware of it, because this is really Cold War thinking when you think of when you recall the Cuban Missile Crisis of the early 1960s.
Sure. It is very much this idea of zero sum. Anything that any country, any people that are on one side can't be on the other. You can't, you know, straddle the fence here. You have to pick sides. That kind of thinking, yes, has certainly become more sharper in the recent months.
Let's listen and have you react to this bit of Senator John McCain of Arizona. This week he rose on the floor of the U.S. Senate to respond to Senator Chris Murphy, a Democrat from Connecticut who serves with Senator McCain on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Here's Senator McCain criticizing President Obama's foreign policy.
The fundamental problem here, I say to my friend from Connecticut, is that this president does not understand Vladimir Putin. He does not understand his ambitions. He does not understand that Vladimir Putin is an old KGB colonel bent on restoration of the Soviet, of the Russian Empire. It was Vladimir Putin that said the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century was the downfall of the Soviet Union. The senator from Connecticut should understand that what this is all about, and this president has never understood it. This president is the one that ridiculed Mitt Romney when Mitt Romney said our great enemy was Russia and its geopolitical threats, said the Cold War has been over for 20 years. This president believes the Cold War was over. Vladimir Putin doesn't believe that the Cold War is over.
Okay, so Bill Reisinger, has Senator McCain really put his finger on it? It's really generational that we have a president now that, does he believe the Cold War is over? And facing a president in Russia who longs for the Cold War days of the Soviet Union?
Well, I certainly don't think that Russia is in a position to be a superpower in the world anymore. So that aspect of the Cold War is not going to be recreated. And even if Putin's aim is indeed to recreate the Russian Empire or the Soviet Union or whatever, that more Russian control over the landmass that was formerly controlled by those states, I still am not sure what that would mean for U.S. foreign policy that would be different than what we have done. Ukraine is in Europe. Ukraine borders the European Union. Ukraine is very important for American interests, but it is closer to Russia. It is certainly something where the West can't willy-nilly do what it wants. And so, it's hard to say how important it is that Putin would like to recreate control mm-hmm. over this space. Well, you know, what is the United States concretely going to do about that, other than deal with complex issues in an appropriate way? And so American foreign policy needs to tread carefully. We need to do what we can to raise the cost to Putin of his actions, and his de facto occupation of Crimea is certainly provocative and shouldn't be allowed to go unpunished.
Mm-hmm. So back to Senator McCain's criticism there. He has criticized the president's foreign policy, along with a few other Republicans in Congress. Does President Obama bear some responsibility for actions taken by Russia in Ukraine? This incursion is a projection of weakness internationally by the U.S. If that's what it is, that's the way Senator McCain would characterize it. Has that given Putin the courage to act?
No, I don't. I just don't see the United States' foreign policy isn't facing this problem because it's been weak vis-a-vis Russia. Russia is a nuclear power, and so we can't threaten it. We can't boss it around. So our policy has to be smart, not strong in some abstract sense. If anything, American foreign policy has not been careful enough about how it has pushed the protesters in Ukraine to take hardline stances and to sort of turn this into a crisis that now has become militarized.
You think that our administration pushed them too far?
Sure. I think the and I'm talking very specifically about the point at which the opposition took power in Kiev, and then with encouragement not just from the United States but from our allies in Europe and the European Union, began taking drastic changes in language policy and other things that were not designed to heal Ukraine's wounds and bring the different parts of the country together, and made it very easy for Russia to inflame passions among Ukrainians in the East and provide the pretext for Russia to use its military.
Mm-hmm. The Russians, Putin says the government currently in Kiev is illegitimate. The Western powers say it's a legitimate government. How do you see it?
It's a government by lack of any alternatives. I think its legitimacy is very open to question, and they need to hold elections as soon as possible to get a leadership that has that democratic legitimacy. Yanukovych clearly has no legitimacy, even though he was not removed by constitutional means. Nonetheless, his own actions seem to have made his further control of the country absolutely impossible.
His unpopularity, his corruption.
His corruption, his giving orders to shoot at the protesters. If indeed he did that, we still have a very difficult time determining how things played out in those crucial moments. But he certainly, yes, he was clearly stealing in staggering sums from his people, and he was allowing others to do so in even bigger volumes. So his corruption really, I think, undermines his claim to legitimacy. But the new leaders, although they come from the parliaments, represent very small portions of the Ukrainian people and don't have the kind of claim to democratic legitimacy that they need to get as soon as possible.
If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour is Bill Reisinger, professor of political science at the University of Iowa. He's written extensively about authoritarian politics, democratization, and the politics of post-communist countries, talking about the crisis in Ukraine. You've looked at President Putin's character, and this is one of the big enigmas of this crisis, is what is President Putin thinking? Tell us a little bit about what you believe he's thinking and the type of Russia he has shaped that is influencing the actions we're seeing right now.
Yeah, he's in a very strong yet weak position within Russia in a very particular sense. He is un challenged as the political leader, and he's able to mobilize all the forces necessary from strong majorities in parliament to pass whatever laws he would like, to obedience on the part of the state apparatus, etc. So a very strong control of the political system in Russia. Yet, in a sense, he is constantly being forced to personally get involved in decision-making and to adjudicate between rival groups of politicians, rival outlooks, and what Russians call clans, groupings that have different policy points of view and are fighting each other and backstabbing constantly. So he spends an enormous amount of time just trying to keep the lid on the pot of Russian elite politics. One of the results of his strong personal control and his sort of constant maneuvering back and forth among different political forces in the leadership is that he isn't able to get good information. He isn't able to have the ability for decisions to be considered as wisely, I think, as they ought to be. And I think this current invasion of Crimea is something that's kind of rash and doesn't sound to me like it was well thought out. He's going to be able to get backing for it, but in the long run, if it drags on, I'm not sure the Russian people will find it a very popular move, and I'm not sure that a lot of the Ukrainians that he's counting on to support it will in fact want Russia to occupy their land.
You spoke of the Russian people. What is this crisis in the moment, at the moment, doing to Putin's popularity at home? Is it unifying? Are people unifying behind him, given that there is now a foe abroad in the form of the West pushing its hand as he sees it in Ukraine?
Yeah, there's certainly a rally around the flag effect that we see in almost every society when some kind of military engagement is involved. He has control of the mass media, the television in particular, in ways that have allowed him to really send out a strong and continuous, almost uninterrupted message to the Russian people about the situation in Ukraine, portraying the opposition as neo-Nazis and thugs and very threatening to Russian-speaking citizens in Ukraine, etc. So, yes, I assume, I haven't seen recent surveys, but I assume his popularity has gone up in response to recent events. It was already above 50%, closer to 60, and on a long-term downward trend over the last 5 years or so, but nonetheless still at a level that is perfectly adequate for him to take strong action, and definitely some rally around the flag effect is going on now. Russians who are on the internet, who are blogging and tweeting about this, tend to predominantly favor action to protect Russian interests in Ukraine and pretty strongly express support for the idea that Crimea, the peninsula in the south of Ukraine, should never have been given to Ukraine back in the 1950s and really is part of Russia and ought to be brought back into Russia.
Mm-hmm. Expand on that a little bit. That's very interesting because this is the part of Ukraine where, well, Crimean, what is it described as self-defense forces have surrounded Ukrainian military forces, also where reports of Russians as well, Russian troops. So it used to be part of Russia about a half century ago, then became part of Ukraine. How did that happen?
The Soviet Union's leader at the time, Nikita Khrushchev, gave the Crimean Peninsula to the Ukrainian Republic, all within the same country. So it was a gift on the anniversary of Kiev and Rus, and he said, "Let's therefore move it from what would be the equivalent of one U.S. state to another."
Mm.
So let's take Rock Island and change which state it belongs to.
Do you see in any way the possibility of somehow Crimea, Crimean Peninsula, returning to Russia in this crisis as sort of a poker chip that part of a compromise?
No, I don't think so. I think the principles of respect for international boundaries would make that just not acceptable to major powers around the world. What is quite possible still, it seems to me, if negotiations are not able to go where they should, is that Crimea will de facto become independent from Ukraine. It will be a Russian protectorate, not formally annexed into Russia proper, but de facto will operate as if it is part of Russia. That is, its people will be acknowledged by Russia to be a different country from Ukraine, but almost no other world countries will grant them that recognition. So they will trade mostly with Russia. They will have Russian passports. This is the way that the breakaway regions of Georgia have been handled since the war in 2008 in Georgia. It's what, you know, we refer to them as frozen conflicts. There's not actual fighting, but their status in world affairs is remains kind of at a very ambivalent place.
What do you see happening from this point on? The talks, of course, in Paris today. What are the possible scenarios you see going forward in the coming days and weeks?
No one wants a clash, either between NATO armies and Russia, certainly, but not even between Ukraine's army and Russian forces. That could spiral into something much more dangerous very quickly. And I think all the diplomats who are talking about this will do what they can to avoid that. But the Western allies need to raise the cost to Russia of maintaining control over Crimea and potentially of invading the eastern part of Ukraine proper, and give Russia incentives to back out of that. Mm-hmm. And in exchange, Ukraine's current leaders, those who control the rest of Ukraine, need to start trying to calm tensions in their own country and be willing to make assurances to Russia that they will not be a hostile force on Russia's border. So some people, such as Zbigniew Brzezinski, have mentioned the status that Finland had during the Soviet period vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. That is, they did not join NATO. They maintained very friendly relations with the Soviet Union, even as they became part of the West and had a capitalist economy and other things and traded with Western Europe freely. And they just made very sure that they did not let the Soviet Union see them as a threat.
We have just about a minute left. Back to the point you just made about raising the cost to President Putin. Do you see President Putin paying attention to the cost that is being put before him by Western leaders? Is he paying attention? Does he care? Have you seen that in his behavior in recent days?
In the short run, Russia's economy would allow it to ignore economic sanctions and certainly diplomatic sanctions. In the medium run, several years or longer, those penalties can be very severe. Russia's economy is not growing at a decent rate. They need to reinvest in their energy extraction technology if they're going to continue to be able to sell oil and natural gas on world markets and to customers such as China. They have an elite that is supporting Putin, but whose money depends on their investments abroad and things. So there's many ways in which Russia is vulnerable to economic pressure, and we can't know whether Putin will really be willing to see the economy hurt, Russia's economy hurt, because of his foreign policy, but he may well be, but that's really going to harm Russia.
Bill Reisinger, thank you so much, Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa.
My pleasure.
When we come back, we'll talk with our regular political analyst, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, will be with us. I hope you'll join our conversation as we continue to discuss the crisis in Ukraine. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. More of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, also a local perspective, local perspectives on the Ukrainian crisis. We'll have Dean Bokopoulos on this program. He's a writer in residence at Grinnell College, but he's also a Ukrainian American, and there are millions of Ukrainian Americans. He happened to grow up in a Ukrainian immigrant community in metropolitan Detroit, grew up speaking Ukrainian, and we'll get his view, which no doubt represents many Ukrainian-American views on the crisis going on. That's what our focus is on this Hour of Politics, once again focusing on the crisis in Ukraine. Joining us this half hour, Jim McCormick, professor and chair of political science at Iowa State University. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. So glad you could join us again as this crisis continues to unfold. We want to reach out to our listeners. What are your questions as you've watched the crisis and heard about it unfold in Ukraine? And what are your thoughts about U.S. involvement there, U.S. statements, what John Kerry is doing? He's in Paris at the moment. I think we're awaiting a press conference from our Secretary of State. Do you think the Obama administration is pursuing the right path of pressure and diplomacy? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Jim, talks going on in Paris, perhaps having finished up between the U.S. and the Russian envoy there. What do you know about what is being talked about? What do you imagine? We won't actually know until this press conference comes up.
Well, one of the things I think the U.S. would try to do, as well as their European allies, is to get observers into the Crimea, and also I think try to give some sense of confidence to Russia that they will look after sort of eastern Ukraine, so there is not any mistreatment, if you will, of those that are Russian speakers or are ethnic Russians. I mean, I think that would be – that's one of the principal goals, at least to what we can gather so far, that Secretary of State Kerry is trying to do. I did note that the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE, has sent in some observers already to Kiev, and maybe they'll go on to the Crimea as well. So I think that's part of the strategy, is to, if you will, tone down the you know, sort of the military presence, or at least to give confidence to both sides that there would be some kind of impartial observers there. That's a very small step, it seems to me, in terms of resolving this matter.
President Obama yesterday, Jim, characterized Russia's incursion into Ukraine not as a sign of strength, but as a miscalculation that will push former Soviet bloc nations further from Russia. Let's listen.
There is a strong belief that Russia's action is violating international law. I know President Putin seems to have a different set of lawyers making a different set of interpretations, but I don't think that's fooling anybody. I think everybody recognizes that although Russia has legitimate interests in what happens in a neighboring state, that does not give it the right to use force as a means of exerting influence inside of that state.
And visiting Kiev, Ukraine yesterday, Secretary of State John Kerry also condemned Russia's actions.
It is not appropriate to invade a country and at the end of a barrel of a gun dictate what you are trying to achieve.
Okay, John Kerry yesterday. Jim McCormick, what's the symbolism of sending John Kerry directly to Kiev, the message?
Well, I think the message is of American support and, you know, untainted kind of American support for this. I think the other message is that he's trying to convey is to our European allies that they should really join force here. You know, your previous point was that, you know, what's the impact of this going to be on some of the, you know, newer states within NATO? I think that makes them even more frightened of the Russians. I noticed that Secretary Hagel testified before Congress here that they're going to speed up joint exercises, particularly with countries in the Baltic. I think that's what's going to produce this kind of unity. You know, in your last half hour, you had talking about rally around the flag in Russia. I think what this is going to do is create a rally effect within Ukraine, but also within those countries very close to Russia here, who have already been skeptical. And I think that's what the president was talking about, that this sort of will backfire in some ways in terms of actually providing more unity for the West rather than less.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's mixed in there also perhaps feelings that the United States, given U.S. actions over the past years in many regions around the world is being a bit hypocritical. Is that mixed in as well?
Well, I suppose it is. I mean, you know, in terms of the U.S. intervention in
exactly.
other countries.
Yes.
Yeah, I understand. And so that certainly will be raised, I suspect, by Sergei Lavrov, you know, the Soviet foreign minister, or maybe by President Putin himself, in terms of talking, intervening where we saw threats to U.S. interests here, and the failure to go through international bodies, and certainly we can put that back to the Russians. But I think that. That is the suggestion that maybe the 21st century hasn't taken over all of American foreign policy or Soviet foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. Here's the latest on what's going on in Paris. Russia rebuffing Western demands to withdraw forces in Ukraine's Crimea region. And also these talks aimed at easing the tensions, averting a risk of war. It seems, does it not, Jim, that all sides, both sides, are wanting to avoid any hot war?
No, I think they really are treading very lightly, and I'm very glad to see that. There's been very few shots fired in the Crimea. I guess some warning shots, but other than that, there has not been any kind of violence, if you will.
Okay, your questions, your comments as we watch the crisis in Ukraine unfurl. 1-866-780-9100. Jim McCormick is with us, one of our regular political analysts. He's a professor and chair of political science at Iowa State University. Jim, let's do go to our phones.
Sure.
John is in Des Moines. Hi, John. What is on your mind
hey,
as you
how
listen?
Are you doing?
Doing
yeah,
well.
My concern or thought is this. You know, we've got bases that we've had for 40, 50 years, like in Japan. It's a strategic area for us. We also know that the Chinese are exerting a little more influence in the area and stuff. We're very nervous about that. Do you think that if the Chinese did anything to challenge our bases there, that we would act any different than Russia is with these bases in Crimea? I mean, I guess the point is I don't like Putin. I don't trust him. But quite frankly, I have a little problem with Washington, D.C., too. And it looks to me like, you know, some of the information about our incursion into Iraq really draws some very big questions. You know, Kuwait was a different deal. We were trying to get people out when they were in over a boundary, but, you know, quite frankly, I just don't know where our moral high ground on
right.
this is, you know.
Okay, John, there's the point from Des Moines. Do we have moral high ground to stand on? Thank you, John, from Des Moines.
Well, I think what was different, of course, about Japan and Korea, you know, if the Chinese were to take any incursion or whatever was suggested. We have treaty obligations, and certainly we would consult with our allies. I don't think there's – I mean, there is a pact, actually, between Russia and the Ukraine over access to the naval base that they have at Sevastopol here. But I don't think it allows them to intervene in terms of protecting ethnic Russians here. I mean, the procedure to do that, as Secretary Kerry really has implied, is that, yes, there is obviously a concern when ethnic groups might be under attack, although that may be fabricated as well, at least in my mind. But there are other channels. There are certainly international organizations and bilateral relations that could be undertaken rather than simply sending in forces.
Let's go to Rick. Rick is in Iowa City. What's on your mind, Rick?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
This comes back to the political climate here in America. I always grew up hearing that politics stop at the water's edge, or however that cliche goes. And with the clamoring of McCain and Lindsey Graham, and especially Rudy Giuliani, who seemed to almost gush admiration for Putin's decisiveness and leadership, and then going back to the newer the day feckless and attacking the president for being weak, I'm not sure how that actually helps his position and his reputation in the world. So I was just wondering what the panel might think about that.
Rick, very good point. Has this changed, Jim McCormick? Didn't it used to be that
Politics stops at the water's edge.
Yes.
I mean, that's that goes back to about 1947 or so in terms of Senator from Michigan, Vandenberg, who talked about getting together with the president and supporting the president. Unfortunately, bipartisanship on foreign policy, as we've seen on domestic policy, has eroded. Certainly on the foreign policy arena has not eroded as sharply as it has on the domestic arena. But increasingly, I'm afraid I have to say that foreign policy has become, contentious across party lines. And there really are different visions, if you will, of what the United States should be doing in the world.
But these are all unwritten rules. There's nothing saying that a senator or anybody can speak out against the president or the secretary of state.
Sure. This is freedom of speech dominates here, of course. But I think it used to be more muted to give the administration a chance. I noticed on one of your earlier broadcasts that Speaker Boehner, said that they're going to pass the aid package for Ukraine, the $1 billion, as an effort to strengthen the President Obama's hand, and obviously hopes the Senate would go along with that. But at the same time, he took a bit of a swipe, at the president. So I think this is the kind of dual messages that we sometimes see in a partisan way.
Mm. You don't see it as an opportunity to unite in Washington. It doesn't seem like it does.
I don't think so because, this is not obviously the first time that Putin has sort of exercised some muscle. I mean, the Bush administration has this. And I mean, my view is that probably the outcome in the Crimea is going to be very similar to the outcome in South Ossetia, where to this day, of course, Russian yeah. forces remain there.
A cynical view, but how? Well, no, I'm talking about what I'm about to say.
Oh, okay.
a cynical view that how much would this exist? People in Washington not wanting to hand the president a foreign policy achievement before the November elections, seeing it only through that lens or primarily through that lens.
Yeah, I mean that. That I hope would not happen. I mean, certainly there would be criticism of the way it's handled, but I think if the president were to and his national security team were able to get some kind of extraction of these Russian forces, I think there would be really a rally effect and support for the president.
Let's go to Mary in Iowa City. Thank you for calling 1-866-780-9100. Hi, Mary.
Hi. You know, Putin is not going to back down. And you got to remember that Ukraine is a buffer state. Russia has always wanted to surround itself with buffer states ever since Stalin. And one thing Putin has on his side, it's true, the Ukrainians hate Russians because Russians have always been the occupiers. And people will say, and even when I met Russian students when I was at UNI, I'm a Ukrainian. So, and then if Ukraine wasn't a buffer state, Russia would be glad to get rid of it because Ukraine and Greece are the same type of basket cases. So the United States can try to buy it off in Europe, but it's not going to work. And Europe has an economic interest in Russia, especially Germany. They get their heat, their oil, and their gas from Russia. So this is a European problem. This is not our problem.
Thank you, Mary, from Iowa City. How much – what do you see as the biggest levers we have in influencing Vladimir Putin, Jim McCormick?
Well, the argument is that we have these economic levers that we can use both on banks and on the economic relations more generally. But the real problem is in putting those into effect is certainly there's a time span that would be as Bill Reisinger said last half hour. But I think the other point is, and that what I really like to add, is that the dependence on the EU countries for Russian natural gas for their energy needs is really quite substantial. I took the liberty to look up the number. It's about 35% of the natural gas that is imported into the EU countries comes from Russia. The other complication of this is that some of that gas goes through pipelines that are in Ukraine, and Ukraine gains some transshipment fees for sending that gas on. And, of course, that's an economic incentive, if you will, for the Ukrainians. So it seems to me using some of those economic sanctions, might really be very, very difficult to do. And, of course, within the past actually 24 hours or so, both Germany and the U.K. have balked a bit, little bit about imposing either bank sanctions.
You think that softening is also due to the energy needs they have flowing through Ukraine?
Absolutely. I think as well as the investments that were talked about here that Germany in particular has in Russia.
Okay. Hal is with us in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Hal.
Well, my question is, it arises from an article in the New York Review of Books here by Timothy Snyder at Yale, and he says that Ukrainians are making real sacrifices for the hope of joining the European Union. And by that he means that these people that have been shot in the head or neck by snipers in Kiev at Maidan Square, those are the people we should be listening to. Well, of course, they're dead, but we should be listening to their survivors, their parents, their families, rather than listening to Putin and his big program for the Eurasian Union, or even Obama with his great promotion of democracy. I mean, he has gone all over the world, everywhere, speaking. But we need to listen to the people that are suffering, the people that are paying the price. The Ukrainians want a Western way of life. They don't want to be part of Russia. They don't want to be under the thumb of a dictator.
Mm-hmm.
And we should be listening to those people. That's my comment.
Hal, thank you, Cedar Rapids caller Hal. To what extent can we make that as a blanket statement, Jim McCormick, that all Ukrainians aspire to this, especially when we go to the Crimean Peninsula, where, 70% are Russians?
Sure. I mean, if you look also at the distribution of Russian native language speakers, particularly, I mean, Russia has a good point in terms of the ethnic makeup, particularly of the eastern part of the country, and between 50% and 75% of them are their native language is Russian. It's unclear, though, and that's why it would be good to get a little bit more information about the tilt of their loyalties. And I guess my sense is, if there might be some rally effect, as I said earlier, to the Kiev government rather than what might impinge upon them from Russia.
I'm seeing a headline here, Senator McCain slamming Hagel for a failure on Ukraine intel. Once this is under control, some more stability, will that then inevitably come up? How did this Putin's move, his actions in Ukraine, take so many in the West by surprise, a failure of our intelligence community?
Well, as I always tell my students, the intelligence community is quite good at trend kind of predictions, but at point predictions, I'm sure this was on the radar screen that the Russians might be, having these exercises in Western Russia and so on. But to make the point kind of point prediction of exactly when that would happen is really a difficulty for the intelligence community. So I think we have to be a little bit more sanguine about how effective we can be in terms of predicting exactly when things will occur.
Kay is with us from Coralville. Kay, we're not running out of time. What's your point or your question?
One point is I'm disappointed that the media pays little attention to the fact that this overthrow that occurred in the Ukraine was unconstitutional. Those people could have just waited until the May election. Also, I would like it clarified, what exactly is the Crimea Peninsula? They refer to it as somewhat independent, but I don't know what that means.
Great questions, Kay. So to what extent is that new government in Kiev legitimate, Jim, and the Crimea Peninsula?
Well, I guess I would say that there's a little bit more legitimacy than maybe some would give to it. I mean, there was really an act of parliament. There was an abandonment of the president. I mean, obviously under pressure, I understand that, Yanukovych, but he moved immediately to the east, and there were at least formal procedures. So, I mean, I know this is a good Russian talking point in terms of the illegitimacy of the government, but I think it's a lot more legitimate than having Russian troops moving the Crimea here and under what I would say are sort of questionable pretenses. The Crimea, is this region obviously that was turned over to Ukraine in 1954. That was mentioned previously. It does have the Russian naval base, an important Russian naval base. And, you know, to the extent that, you know, whether it would become an autonomous regent or not is, I think, is, you know, that's maybe a likely outcome. I think the other outcome, of course, is what Russian presence there, if it remains, is what it does to the Ukrainian government in Kiev. I think it makes them a little bit more conscious of looking eastward as well as they try to move westward.
Jim, we've come to the end of the hour, but amazing to think that the Winter Olympics, now seeming so distant, were just a few days ago wrapping up, a proud moment for Russia on the international stage, a moment that Putin was willing to invest $50 billion in.
And the most most medals too, as I recall.
Correct. And now juxtaposed with that with what we have today. Interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Jim McCormick, professor and chair of political science at Iowa State University. Always great to have your insights, Jim. We look forward to hearing from you again.
Thank you very much.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, we continue tomorrow with a local view on the Ukrainian crisis. A writer in residence at Grinnell College and Ukrainian American, Dean Bakopoulos, will join us. He grew up in a Ukrainian immigrant community in the metropolitan Detroit area. He's got some interesting stories to tell about his family and why Ukrainians feel the way they do about their neighbor, Russia. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. And in Ames, help from Jason Burns and Garrett Van Leeuwen. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We hope to tune in again tomorrow over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.